Good afternoon. I'm Kurt Dewhurst. I'm the director of the Center for Great Lakes Culture, and I want to welcome you all here to the library colloquium. We're very appreciative of the relationship the center has established with MSU Library Colloquium Series, and we've been able to have some of our presentations of various programs. Ken Lewis did a program here not too long ago. Folks who are doing Great Lakes culture research, and we're very pleased today that our speaker is Susan Applegate Krause, who is Oklahoma Cherokee, and she's also an assistant professor in the Department of Anthropology, and she's the assistant curator of Great Lakes Ethnology at the MSU Museum. And over this past year, Susan was awarded one of the fellowships that the Center for Great Lakes Culture gives. It gives one fellowship each year to an MSU faculty member, and in the past also gives fellowships. In the past, we've done them for visiting scholars at different levels, but Susan is the MSU Fellow of the Year. Somehow, fellow doesn't seem quite right, the choice of words here. Her research focus, as many of you know, is on North American Indians, especially Native people in Great Lakes communities. And I'm especially pleased to have her talk about the project that she's been working on now for some time, looking at Ho-Chunk Memorial Day powwow activities at Black River Falls, Wisconsin, because not only will this be a valuable research project that she continues to work on and write about, but it's also going to take the form of an exhibition at the Michigan State University Museum opening next March, and she's working on that. So you'll get a chance to see some of these photographs with a wonderful collaborator she may say a few words about yet today. So please join me in welcoming Susan Applegate Krause. Susan.
Thank you, Kurt. That was a wonderful introduction. And I want to thank Kurt also as the director of the Center for Great Lakes Culture. In addition to his duties as director of the museum, he also has taken that on. And that, of course, is the organization that has funded this particular research. And I'm very grateful for the fellowship that I have had this year. The research is ongoing. I may actually get myself an article out of this, which all the untenured faculty in the room will appreciate. but it has been really a wonderful collaboration. So I guess without further ado, I have a prepared talk. What I'd like to do is launch into that. In the middle of that will be some slides. And then we will have, I think, plenty of time at the end for some questions or comments or criticism or whatever. So let me launch into this. Title of my talk is Ho-Chunk Warriors. In the feature film, Dances with Wolves, the warrior, wind in his hair, rides across the screen on his own personal quest for glory. This image of the American Indian pervades the American consciousness, obscuring the reality of contemporary Native peoples and cultures. The sculptures of Frederick Remington, the paintings of George Catlin, the photographs of Edward Curtis all portray the Indian warrior, long black hair and feathers blowing in the wind, mounted on horseback, pursuing a buffalo or the cavalry. Miniature plastic Indian warriors can be purchased in any toy store, packaged with plastic cowboys and ready to fight. Advertisements appear in the Sunday magazine of your newspaper for decorative collector plates that highlight depictions of lone braves accompanied only by their guardian spirits. All of these images suspend the warrior in a never-ending chase, ready for battle, separated from any family or community life. On the contrary, Tom Jones is making photographs of Indian warriors. Tom Jones, not the singer, the photographer, is a Ho-Chunk or Winnebago. His pictures of warriors are very different from the lone warrior stereotype that has become so familiar. Tom Jones has chosen to focus on the images of Ho-Chunk veterans as the center of a Memorial Day celebration that rounds out a weekend of powwow and homecoming for the Ho-Chunk people of Wisconsin. Tom Jones' photographs celebrate the connections between Ho-Chunk warriors, past and present, and their homes, families, and communities. I was invited by Tom to the 2001 Memorial Day celebration to begin a collaboration of words and images about Ho-Chunk veterans. My research has included work on powwows, American Indian veterans, and photographs of Indians, so my interests meshed well with Tom's project to photograph Ho-Chunk veterans at the powwow. My particular interest in the Ho-Chunk Memorial Day powwow was in how this community used the powwow to honor its veterans. While veterans are integral to all powwows, and American Indian people have always respected their warriors, the Ho-Chunk community makes a special effort at the Memorial Day powwow to acknowledge the sacrifices of veterans on behalf of their people. Most images of Indian warriors are generic warriors, without an identified tribe or nation. Tom Jones' photographs are of Ho-Chunk warriors, rooted in a place and a specific set of traditions. In my talk today, I want to give you some background on the Ho-Chunks, then discuss the Memorial Day powwow itself, and show you some slides from the celebration. Those are going to be my slides, my photographs, and then at the end, I'm going to show you Tom Jones's images of Ho-Chunk warriors. I think the contrast will be clear. Let me begin then with some background. The Ho-Chunk were formerly known as the Winnebago. Winnebago comes from a Meskwaki word that means people of the stinking water. So you can imagine why the Ho-Chunk people have recently reclaimed their own name for themselves, which comes from the word Ho-Chungra, meaning people of the big voice. The Ho-Chunk homeland has been in western Wisconsin for as long as anyone can remember, but the Ho-Chunk people were removed from their homeland by the US federal government beginning in the 1830s and continuing in a series of removals for almost 50 years. Many Ho-Chunk people ended up in Nebraska, where they have retained the name Ho-Chunk, or retained the name Winnebago, and formed the Nebraska-Winnebago Nation Reservation. Many other Ho-Chunks resisted removal or returned to Wisconsin and established scattered settlements across 12 counties in the state. They formally organized their tribal government in 1963 and began building a political and economic base that today serves nearly 6,000 Wisconsin Ho-Chunks. Black River Falls is the tribal headquarters for the nation in Wisconsin, and that, just to place it for you geographically, that's about two-thirds of the way north in Wisconsin and a little more to the west than it is central. So Black River Falls is the tribal headquarters, and it is to this place that people return to celebrate and remember their veterans. The Ho-Chunk culture is often referred to as a warrior culture, both by scholars and by the people themselves. In his classic 1923 monograph, The Winnebago Tribe, anthropologist Paul Radin described how the culture was linked with war. Quote, "War was one of the most important elements in the life of the Winnebago. The life of the warrior was the ideal toward which all men strove. It not only satisfied certain emotional needs, but it was so inextricably interwoven with social standing in the community and with individual prestige that Winnebago life is unthinkable without it." End quote. Radin explained that a Winnebago man might choose to go to war specifically to enact revenge for the death of a relative, or more generally, to become a warrior and acquire the honors reserved for warriors. In more traditional times, Before sustained contact with Europeans and Americans, Ho-Chunk men might readily form a war party or join a war party against their traditional enemies, including Ojibwes, Sioux, and Fox. They also fought in conflicts involving the British and the Americans, for example, siding with the British and their Shawnee ally Tecumseh in the War of 1812. As the Ho-Chunks came increasingly under the influence of the United States government, it became more difficult for men to achieve warrior status. In an autobiography written at the request of anthropologist Paul Radin, Ho-Chunk Sam Blowsnake, better known as Big Winnebago or Crashing Thunder, Blowsnake recounted how he and three friends decided, quote, to obtain war honors, end quote, by stealing some horses and killing their owner. They hoped by their actions to be able to wear the eagle feathers reserved for warriors. However, this took place in the late 1890s, by which time American authorities did not look favorably on the pursuit of war honors in this fashion by young Ho-Chunk men. Sam Blowsnake was arrested and tried for murder. He and two of his companions were acquitted, and only the actual murderer was imprisoned. In Ho-Chunk tradition, however, all four were considered warriors since they had touched or counted coup on the victim. For Ho-Chunks then, military service for the United States became the pathway to becoming a warrior. Nancy Lurie, another anthropologist who has worked extensively with the Ho-Chunks, commented on the revitalization of Ho-Chunk warrior culture through military service. First observed by Leo Sroll among Ho-Chunk veterans of World War I, Sroll noted that service in World War I provided, quote, new life and vitality to the culture, and by forming a prestige group long extinct, they strengthened the entire social structure, end quote. Nancy Lurie went on to point out that World War II and other conflicts of the 20th century produced veterans who took on leadership roles in the establishment of the Ho-Chunk Nation in Wisconsin. Their service in the U.S. military also enabled Ho-Chunks to continue their warrior traditions in ways that were culturally appropriate and relevant to the entire community, not just the warriors themselves. Some of you may have read the autobiography of Mountain Wolf Woman, which was edited by Nancy Lurie. And in that autobiography, Mountain Wolf Woman recounted a victory dance that she participated in following World War II, where she danced with the scalp of a German soldier brought back by her Ho-Chunk relatives. For Mountain Wolf Woman, this was a powerful ceremony rooted in Ho-Chunk traditions. And she was blessed with a vision of the slain German soldier following the 2 days of dancing. The Ho-Chunks recognized the connection between contemporary military service and their traditions of warrior behavior. The Ho-Chunk Nation Veterans Affairs Committee has recently been pushing for a Veterans Service Office to be part of the tribe's Department of Heritage Preservation, not their Social Services Department, not some other department, but to be specifically in this Heritage Preservation Office. Members of the Veterans Affairs Committee commented that placement of the office within this department, quote, would be meaningful in that Ho-Chunk heritage is based on the warrior culture, end quote. Service in the United States military is not only culturally appropriate for Ho-Chunks, it is acceptable to the larger American society in ways that more traditional warfare is not. Ho-Chunk warriors, like other American Indian servicemen and women, serve two nations, their own Ho-Chunk Nation and the United States. American Indians from many tribes have fought for the U.S. in every war since the American Revolution, enlisting at rates higher than any other ethnic group. Ho-Chunks themselves began to join U.S. military forces in the Civil War. They continued to serve through World War I, even though they were not citizens of the United States at this time and did not receive U.S. citizenship until 1924. Following the granting of citizenship, Ho-Chunks could be drafted, but most still chose to enlist. Many Ho-Chunks have distinguished themselves in U.S. military service. The local American Legion post at Black River Falls is named in honor of Andrew Blackhawk, a veteran of World War I who lost an arm in the conflict in France. Mitchell Red Cloud Jr. received the Medal of Honor for service in the Korean War. Ho-Chunk people have continued to serve, fighting in conflicts from Vietnam to Bosnia, and continuing that tradition of service today in this latest conflict in Iraq. Ho-Chunks recognize the participation of their people in the various branches of the military, and they have specific honor songs for the Army, Navy, Marines, and Air Force. Let me pause now, and I want to begin the slides. Thank you. Great. For some 50 years, the Ho-Chunk Nation has hosted a Memorial Day powwow. It takes place on the Andrew Blackhawk Powwow Grounds near Black River Falls, Wisconsin, on land donated by this veteran of World War I. The grounds are anchored by the powwow circle. At the very center is a covered arbor, which you can see, where the host drums sit, groups of men who sing to accompany the drum. A dance circle surrounds the drums. Over the powwow weekend, it is filled with dancers in full regalia, competing for prize money. Spectators sit in covered bleachers around the dance space, and surrounding them is a ring of traders selling crafts and foods. Cars, campers, and tents are scattered across the rest of the grounds. Veterans are central to many of the events of the contemporary powwow, not only at the Ho-Chunk Nation, but across North America. Veterans carry the flags that lead the dancers into the dance circle. Should a dancer drop an eagle feather during the powwow, four veterans must retrieve that feather, which represents a fallen warrior who must be cared for by other warriors. A veteran is the only person who can bestow an eagle feather on another person, and among the Ho-Chunks, that veteran must have seen combat. Reuben Snake, a Nebraska Winnebago, explained how a veteran might bestow a feather on a niece or granddaughter, saying, quote, "We place a feather upon her as a sign of our sacrifice to remember some brave deed that we might have performed on the field of combat," end quote. A veteran's honor song is the final part of the grand entry that opens each session of dancing at the powwow. Tom Holm, himself a Cherokee Creek veteran of Vietnam, in his study of American Indian service in Vietnam, quoted a Ho-Chunk elder who explained the veterans' honor song, quote, "We honor our veterans for their bravery, and because by seeing death on the battlefield, they truly know the greatness of life," end quote. Powwows are common events in Indian country, but this one at the Ho-Chunk Nation over Memorial Day weekend is special, since it integrates both living and dead veterans. A circle of more than 70 white painted flagpoles stands just outside the powwow seating area. The powwows are empty until the morning of Memorial Day, when they receive the service flags of Ho-Chunk veterans. These are the flags that are presented by the United States Armed Forces to the families of deceased veterans. Families fly their veteran service flags in tribute and in memory on Memorial Day morning as a traditional drum plays and sings a Ho-Chunk flag song. It is the responsibility of veterans to raise and lower the service flags on Memorial Day. Some families no longer have living veterans among their members, so veterans circulate among the flagpoles, making sure that every family and every flag has at least two warriors to care for them. Extra veterans are called to where they are needed, summoned by the families or the master of ceremonies. I love this slide. This is a friend of mine, Dennis Shepherd, who's a Potawatomi. He's a traditional dancer. He was running between flagpoles all morning, getting called on, and then some family member would show up, and they'd go, okay, we don't need you now, and then he'd go to somebody else's. It's just the kind of thing that veterans do. Warriors serve and protect the people, symbolized by their role at the flag raising. And I just want to show you several of these scenes during the preparation for the flag raising. There are a lot of flags. There were 50 some at both of the last two powwows that I've been to.
Are those cedar poles?
Oh, I think they are a mixture of whatever people can get. So on this morning, the flags are raised to the top of the staffs and then lowered slowly to half staff. The flags remain at half staff for the morning. Then at noon, the families and their veterans raise them to full height, where they fly above the powwow grounds until evening. It is moving to see more than 50 flags surrounding the powwow grounds, and more moving still to realize that each one represents a warrior who has passed on. One man expressed this to me when I admired the flag he raised for his father, whom he had never met. The father was killed in World War II, but as this man said, quote, "When I see that flag waving in the breeze, I know that's my dad's spirit and that he is here," end quote. The emblem of these warrior service is an American flag, which Ho-Chunks have made their own, honoring it with flag songs. One of these songs was composed by two Ho-Chunk veterans of World War I, Andrew Blackhawk, who you've already heard about, the donor of the powwow grounds, and Jim Carriman, who you will hear more about shortly. As recorded by ethnomusicologist Francis Densmore, the song's lyrics said, quote, and of course this is in translation from Ho-Chunk, "I love my flag, so I went to the old world to fight the Germans. If I had not loved the American flag, it would not have come back, but now we are still using it," end quote. Now, there has been a recent exception at the Memorial Day ceremonies to the usual American flags. One flag raised at the Memorial Day celebrations is not an American flag, but rather is a French flag with its distinctive tricolors of blue, white, and red, which I'm sure you can see in the center there. This flag was presented to Henry de Cora in 1982 by the French government, to honor his father, Foster Decora, who was killed in France in World War I and laid to rest there. Henry Decora and his brother Arthur fought alongside their father in World War I, but survived the conflict. Decades after the war, Henry Decora returned to France to the cemetery where his father was buried and brought home a French flag that had flown over the cemetery. He raised it at the Ho-Chunk Memorial Day celebrations, and today his daughter, Vera Decora Kingbird, which you see in the snappy pink pants, Vera and her family continue to honor their veterans by flying the French flag. Being a warrior is part of Ho-Chunk tradition, and Ho-Chunk families often include generations of warriors. The living warriors return to Black River Falls on Memorial Day with their father's and grandfather's service flags, raising them to honor the dead and the living warriors. Extended families join together to remember uncles, nephews, and cousins who have served and who have passed on. The Karaman family is one such multi-generational Ho-Chunk warrior family. Jim Karaman, who with Andrew Blackhawk composed the flag song quoted earlier, served in the U.S. Army in World War I. One story told about him is that when he went, quote, over the top, he gave two war whoops, and then the Germans landed a big shell on the spot. He did it to show the Germans that he was right there, end quote. Jim Karaman died not long after his return from the war, from probably the combined effects of mustard gas and tuberculosis. And he left his wife and three-month-old son behind. Their son, Laverne Karaman, served with the US Army Air Force in World War II in North Africa. His son, another Jim, served in Vietnam. This youngest Karaman now raises flags for his father and grandfather, recognizing their service as his family acknowledged his service when he returned from Vietnam. The Mike family is another family of warriors. Owen Mike, a combat veteran of Vietnam, honored his father's father's brother, Dewey Mike, who was killed in service in World War I, by raising Dewey's service flag and setting up a memorial with photographs and documents. In addition, Owen Mike led an effort to name a cemetery near Neillsville, Wisconsin, in honor of this great uncle, Dewey Mike. Owen Mike never met his warrior ancestor, but has gone to great effort to memorialize his service and his sacrifice. Warriors are an integral part of Ho-Chunk society, honored for their participation in battle and for the wisdom they gained from that experience, looked up to as leaders and guardians of the people. The Ho-Chunk Nation has a website dedicated to their warriors, which explains, quote, "Ho-Chunk warriors are honored whether they died in action or returned home from the war. The honor is in their decision to fight, not in their death by another warrior's hand," end quote. Warriors are remembered specifically on Memorial Day, but their role as protectors of the people is an ongoing responsibility. The veterans who have passed on are memorialized with the flag raising, but the living veterans are honored with a giveaway sponsored by the Andrew Blackhawk American Legion Post. On Memorial Day 2001, more than 100 veterans received navy blue jackets with the post's insignia, recognizing their contributions as warriors. This is another one of those incredibly moving moments when you see 100 big Winnebago veterans out there in these matching jackets. I mean, people were just literally in tears. The veterans are honored as well for their service songs, sung for each of the major branches of the military. Following the giveaway, as the service songs are sung, veterans from each branch, Army, Marines, Air Force, and Navy, come into the dance circle, followed then by their families and well-wishers. In 2001, the Master of Ceremonies gently chided the people for not singing these traditional service songs often enough, remarking that he had heard them more often in the past. He commented that there were even special songs that should be sung to honor specific warrior deeds, such as a Purple Heart song to recognize recipients of the medal awarded to those wounded or killed in action. The Andrew Blackhawk American Legion Post at Black River Falls, Wisconsin, has long included a women's auxiliary who are responsible for planning and carrying out many of the events of the Memorial Day weekend powwow, including, of course, the food and the giveaway. Women are no longer just an adjunct to the veterans organization, however. Departing from the image of the male warrior, women are now among Ho-Chunk veterans. Ho-Chunk women are not yet represented among the veterans whose service flags are raised on Memorial Day, but living Ho-Chunk women veterans are part of the color guard for the flags at the powwow and help with the flag raising. No doubt in the future, women's service flags will be among those raised by Ho-Chunk families. The warriors honored by the Ho-Chunk people at the Memorial Day flag raising are their own, members of families and communities that make up the Ho-Chunk Nation today. The people have not forgotten other veterans, however, and they recognize the contributions of all veterans during the powwow and the flag raising. During the beginning of each session of powwow dancing, there is a special song for veterans. The Master of Ceremonies asks all veterans to come out into the dance circle and lead the dance, and announces that it applies to all warriors, Indian and non-Indian. When the veterans have circled the dance arena one time, the MC asks those people who would like to honor veterans to come out and join the dance. The powwow circle fills with people dancing to remember their warriors. The flagpoles that surround the powwow grounds display more than just flags on Memorial Day. They also serve as mounts for photographs of the veterans, along with arrays of medals and offerings of tobacco. The warriors' images are integrated into the powwow just as living warriors are part of the community. These are not lone warriors. They come with families and a community that needs them and honors them for their service in memorial displays at the flagpoles. Tom Jones, seen here in action, has undertaken a series of photographs of these memorials, documenting their presence as part of the Memorial Day celebration. And now I will switch to Tom's pictures. He's doing a couple of series of these photographs, and the first one is in color and includes scenes of the powwow itself, as well as photographs of the flagpole memorials. And just to reiterate, we are bringing these photographs, the real ones, not the slides, to MSU Museum in just about a year. It will open in March of 2004. And I will urge you over the next year to come to that. So this is the first of some of Tom's color photographs. This is the Karaman family memorial for Laverne Karaman, who you remember, I told you, served in the Army Air Force in North Africa in World War II. Laverne Karaman is the son of Jim Karaman, who served in World War I. And then the other Jim Karaman, the Vietnam veteran, has created this memorial for his father, with his father's service photograph up on the top, his father's service ribbons, and a box for tobacco offerings. The family places packs of cigarettes there, and veterans passing by may take a cigarette or a pack, light up, and in so doing, will offer prayers and thanks for the well-being of this departed warrior and his family. In the background of this photograph, Tom Jones has included the Karaman family tent, where in 2002 they were raffling a hand-carved chess set. And this is one of the things that look at more than just the foreground in these photographs, because they really move you back into what's going on with the rest of the powwow.
What's the object in front of the framed picture at the top?
The object.
Above the box.
Oh, his service ribbons.
That's right.
And the one at the bottom says U.S. Army. It's his service, whatever that's called, insignia. So he's got, Jim has that service ribbon sort of lined up along the edge there. Now, not all of the memorials are so elaborate. The family of Emmanuel Lowe, U.S. Navy, has simply left tobacco in a bowl by his service photograph, and Tom has captured the simplicity and the immediacy of this memorial in this very tightly framed photograph, which is different from some of the other ones that you will see. Benjamin Winashek, the traditional chief of the Ho-Chunks, passed away in 2001, and his family set up this display for him with photographs of the chief in military uniform and in his traditional eagle feather headdress, which was passed on to his son, who became the next traditional chief. In the background, if you can just see up on your left, Tom has captured a Marine in his dress uniform, as well as, of course, the ice machine, an indispensable part of an outdoor powwow and a campground. Tom often includes portraits of the family in the flagpole memorial photographs. This is the Green Deer family with their memorial for Lyle Green Deer Sr. Lyle himself is pictured in his uniform and in traditional Ho-Chunk ceremonial dress, emphasizing his warrior status and his participation in Ho-Chunk culture. Two of the family members in Tom's photograph are dressed in Ho-Chunk applique shirts, these cutwork applique shirts, and those are a very visible symbol of a distinct Ho-Chunk identity. Here's a veteran I have mentioned before. This is Owen Mike. And here he stands beside his great uncle Dewey Mike's memorial in this photograph. Dewey Mike, of course, was killed in action in World War I. Owen Mike, his great, great nephew, displays more than Dewey's service here. Owen's service is visible on his shirt with his service ribbons, and for those not conversant with military symbols, their message is spelled out above each ribbon. And I hope you can see this. Those are his service ribbons, but they're enlarged. That's not how big they would be on a uniform. And then it has the specific type of service that represents just above it. Owen Mike is a veteran, and he wants to make sure that you understand that. And in this case, he is caring for another veteran, his father's father's brother. In Ho-Chunk tradition, this is not just his great uncle, This is his grandfather. It's the same as if it was his own father. Tom has chosen to show this care in the simple gesture of Owen Mike raising Dewey's portrait to the camera and placing his own hand on the picture. This is another one of those really moving photographs for me. Owen Mike is a pretty gruff, tough Vietnam vet, but I don't think that that's what comes across in this kind of picture. The other part of Tom's series of photographs is in black and white. And Tom has chosen here to focus specifically on the photographs that are mounted on the flagpoles. But in the background, we still see the powwow grounds with food stands and tents and cars and the various activities that are part of this community celebration. Here we have Emmett Decora's photograph on the flagpole. And they also take tape and write the names on top so you know which one is your flagpole when you get there that morning. This is the flagpole for Harold Funmaker, who is a relative of Tom's. I believe he is an uncle, although that would be if it's his mother's brother. So it's not quite the same relationship as if it was his father's brother, but it's still a close relative. And here he's shown receiving a service decoration, and this flagpole is set up directly in front of the Funmaker food stand, linking him to that family. I mean, you don't even have to walk very far to raise the flag. This is Melvin Decora's photograph, and I love this because it shows the flag just coming down, sort of caressing the photograph. And then in the back, you've got one of the crafts tents where they sell, you know, beadwork and whatever. And of course, this is Memorial Day morning, and they haven't opened up the crafts tents yet because we're not into the powwow. So you see this shuttered crafts tent, and it gives you this whole context. This is a photograph of Emmanuel Thundercloud, jauntily resting on an Army truck. He's a World War II Army veteran. And of course, Tom has chosen to use this one on the truck with cars in the background. Again, you know, this is not a sacred space in the sense of it being really formal. There's cars parked right outside the powwow grounds. And then this is the last one that I will show right now. Kenneth Little George's photograph is displayed here in front of a food tent, where again we can see customers and also several bags of garbage. This is the fourth day of a weekend-long powwow, and again, this is the context for this. These are memorials, but they are part of a larger set of events. They're not empty, lifeless memorials, but they are vibrant evocations of individuals and their families at a celebration. Tom Jones's photographs of Ho-Chunk veterans show warriors who are connected to their home and to their people. Without doubt, warriors go into battle and to the hunt, but their more important, more long-term role is in their communities. Tom Jones's images remind us that warriors serve the people, and the people honor their warriors in a connection that remains strong and vital from the past to the present. Thank you.
Are you willing to take some questions?
I'd be happy to answer questions, should there be any. Yes?
Were Indian veterans of World War II distributed and through units?
Yes. There have been over the years a number of calls to make all Indian units or all Indian regiments. And aside from a few that get grouped just because they all signed up together, like a whole bunch of Ho-Chunks served together in World War I, and that's how these two sons, Henry and his brother Arthur, ended up serving with their father, Foster, and their cousin, Robert, in one unit. But that was not by design. That just was by happenstance. And in fact, there were some efforts in World War I, and I understand also in World War II, to distribute Indians out because it would help with assimilating Indian people. Now, obviously, that's not the case with the Navajo Code Talkers, who were recruited and served in specific units because of their language abilities. But by and large, what we see is distribution. And you often get stories. People talk about, you know, I was in a unit, and they called me chief. Or there were two of us, and so we were chief one and chief two. And it really was, it was a novelty in most units to have one Indian. Let's see.
Is there an order? There was an inner circle and an outer circle of the polls as to?
There's not really an inner and outer. It's just that they're sort of staggered depending on when they get put up. And it's not by design. It's they've added more and more flagpoles. They just added about 20 more in the last couple of years. And I believe it was for 2000, they repainted all the flagpoles when they put the new ones in. So they look really good right now. That's not going to last, of course, because they sit out in a Wisconsin winter. But no, and where you get your flagpole is entirely dependent on when you show up and tell the master of ceremonies that you're going to raise a flag. And so they go, okay, you're number 47. And you have to go find flagpole 47. You don't always get the same one, although if you go and ask like the fundmakers do, and the fundmakers are a pretty important family in Ho-Chunk, you can say, can I have this one? Because it's right in front of our food stand and we're cooking. And so sometimes people do that, but for people who just show up for the weekend, you just get a number.
Are all these new polls of demographic functional mortality, or is that historic work? Or?
I think that it is because we're losing the veterans of World War II, and the participation of Ho-Chunks in World War II was just massive. So it is that demographic that we're seeing across, you know, all of the U.S. that we're losing those veterans pretty quickly.
Do they have an oral history project?
Yes, they do. Not enough and underfunded. You know, even the arts and history struggle in every nation. But yes, they do. And I actually used some of their archives to get background on some of these. And then I turned around and took everything that I had collected on World War I, Ho-Chunk veterans, and made copies of everything and sent it up there so they can just integrate it in their, they keep their archives by individuals and by families, because there's not that many people that you can't actually have a file on every individual Ho-Chunk. Yes?
Going back to what you referred to as what it means to be a warrior, the story about touching the victim, can you elaborate on, I think you referred to it as a kind of coup?
Yes, and for
What's the backstory?
Ho-Chunks are part of the Siouan tradition of language and in some cases of culture, where touching an enemy is more honorable than killing that enemy because it's more dangerous. It's easy to kill somebody, especially if you sneak up on them or shoot an arrow at them and the arrow gets there, or, you know, nowadays with a bullet. But to run up to that person who may or may not still be alive and touch that person with some kind of ceremonial coup stick, it's sometimes called, or your own weapon without using that weapon is considered, you know, kind of more macho, more warrior-like. And it also allows additional people to kind of use that deed. It's very, you know, like, let's spread out the war honors here and give them to many people.
Are you saying the kind of coup is an actual material or a
acoustic, as it's sometimes seen, and you don't have to have acoustic to count coup, you just run up and tap somebody. But traditionally, in warfare, and I suspect that when Sam Blowsnake went to do this, they were pretty serious about getting these warrior honors. I suspect they probably dressed up and took their ceremonial stuff with them and counted coup with that. But you could do it with a dance staff. You could do it, you know, with anything. But there are these long objects that, I mean, they are sticks. They're often beaded. They have feathers. Sometimes people will tie offerings to them, tobacco or small bundles of something. And that's what you would use.
But they're not generally ceremonial specific.
Yes, they are just supposed to be for that. But then they get carried, like sometimes in powwow photographs, you see people with things that I might call acoustic. That's not a term that's used widely in my experience in Indian country today, because that's not what people do now. And in fact, there's a big, among Ho-Chunks, because there are so many veterans who have not seen combat, it's a big deal now to be a combat veteran. And there is a very sharp distinction made between someone who has been in combat and killed an enemy. Something that is really, this is not part of traditional Ho-Chunk warrior belief. But this is cropping up, and Owen Mike, who you saw his photograph, made this distinction on two specific occasions at the last 2002 powwow in very public pronouncements that this was what a real veteran was. So this, things are changing, things evolve. And I suspect that part of that has to do with just the sheer number of veterans that are around now. Virtually all Native men volunteer to serve in the military. I mean, it's a phenomenal number, way, way above anybody else. And if you don't serve, then you probably have some very good reason for it. Yeah. Well, certainly that's a big part, and we see this at every Indian powwow. There are some sort of more mainstream ways of honoring. The American Indian Veterans Memorial is, they're raising funds for that, and I believe it's going to be in Tucson, Arizona. So we have some of those kinds of efforts. Depending on where the people are from, there's been a real revitalization of some warrior ceremonies among various people, the Enemy Way ceremony among Navajo people, where that's a way of reintegrating a warrior into society, because you know, having been in battle, you really, you're not really fit to be part of sort of regular society. You need to go through a cleansing ceremony. So there's been a tremendous revitalization of that, which of course is chronicled so beautifully in Housemaid of Dawn and in Ceremony, the two novels by Mamadé and Leslie Silko. Other tribes as well. My own nation, the Cherokee people, have a going to water ceremony, which was virtually extinct. I mean, people just didn't do it anymore because it involves, for one thing, you have to have a doctor, an Indian doctor. And we just didn't have any for a long time, but now people are beginning to come back to that. And also because it involves ritual scratching to draw blood, which is then washed off in running water in a stream, not like in the shower, but in a stream. And that has begun to be practiced again. These are not things that would be part of a public ceremony the way, and that's one reason why I think this Ho-Chunk event is so astonishing, because people come, like me, who are not Ho-Chunk, you know, people come who are just in the community, tourists come, And lots and lots of non-Ho-Chunk veterans come because they get these cool jackets and they get a feast, and it's just a really wonderful event. Ned, my husband, talked to a family at the powwow who I did not get to meet, and I don't know how he struck up a conversation with them, but those of you who know Ned know that that's real easy. They were raising a flag for a Ho-Chunk veteran. None of the people were Ho-Chunk. They were all non-Indian people. The woman who was sort of in charge was the second wife of this Ho-Chunk guy, and his Ho-Chunk family was long gone to other kinds of things, and she had gotten his flag when he died, because she's the widow, and she just felt so much that that was something that she should do, that she and her children from her first marriage, none of whom were Ho-Chunk or even Indian, came and raised this flag. And that was perfectly acceptable. That was, they had lots of support. They had veterans among their family, apparently her sons. But it was, you know, that's just like such a nice thing that that can be incorporated in this very public ceremony. I mean, there is nothing about this that is separate. There is nothing that is reserved. I mean, they do try to keep the non-veterans from eating first at the feast, but, you know, that's just sort of normal. So that was a long answer to say, no, I don't actually know of other things that are quite this public in the same sense and that are, you know, a new tradition, to use a sort of anthropological way of looking at it. This is not a traditional ceremony. I mean, obviously, this is, it's only got started about 50 years ago. People don't seem to know anymore when it got started. Sort of post-World War II is what people have told me, but I don't know that. They could have been doing it, you know, whenever.
Well, yeah. Another question is, in the giveaway materials, were there any books that were made? I'm sorry to ask, but, you know,
not this. Because those veterans don't really want quilts. They want those cool windbreakers. But lots of other giveaways at this, including, I don't think I put a slide in here of this.
Particularly veterans quilts, like
right.
You.
Yep, don't do that. They don't do that among the Ho-Chunks. We don't have that tradition, that, at least that I have seen. Although,
sometimes I've, you know, people have bartered and have them sent here.
There was a giveaway. This traditional chief who passed on his son, Benjamin Winishek, passed on. His son, Clayton Winishek, was installed in 2001 as the new traditional chief. And in 2002, one of the funmaker branches of the family gave him a horse at the powwow. It was very, very cool. And in conjunction with this, this friend of mine, Dennis Shepherd, who donated the horse, also had a huge giveaway, including a drum that he had made, a traditional drum, which he gave wrapped in a quilt. So I might have a slide of that. But that was not part of the veterans thing, but really to honor this traditional chief. I mean, Ho-Chunk traditional chiefs serve for life, so that, as people pointed out, you would only see this once in your lifetime if you're lucky. So that was a big deal. And got a horse. I mean, let me also just, yeah, I want to say, I had the great privilege yesterday of going to an opening of photographs by Tom Jones over in Madison, Wisconsin, but it's yet another series that he's doing on his grandfather, his Choka. And Tom is also doing a video of his grandfather, and it just, it was this beautiful, beautiful series of photographs, and it was wonderful to see Tom and his family. But Tom's been doing a lot of this photographing of his own tribe. So I've included here, this is one of those cool things that galleries do, you know, when you put together these nice layouts, and you're welcome to come and look at these. including one photograph of Tom's grandfather, Jim Funmaker, so you can see that. And then also have some of the small photographs, the black and whites of the series of the flagpole memorials, which also you're welcome to look at. Tom is a masterful photographic printer. And I'm really pleased and excited that we're going to bring his photographs here. When we bring them to the museum, we hope that they will be nearly life-size, so that when you see these, we're going to put up little flagpole things in the middle of the gallery and then have these images that right now Tom's printing them about this big. So I think they're going to be really evocative and just technically very strong, but also then seeing this wonderful imagery of the way that people honor their veterans. Yes?
I just had a quick question. I don't know if I caught it right, but were they known as the Winnebago tribe, and then they referred to themselves as Ho-Chunk,
They were originally Ho-Chunk, or something like that. That's kind of an anglicized pronunciation, but it's one that most people agree on today. Some people actually do use the word Ho-Chungra, but they're kind of seen as too ultra-traditional for anybody else to deal with.
Winnebago was
an anglicized version of a Meskwaki word, and it's... Yep. Yeah, I mean, people don't like this when you reclaim your heritage. It's a lot of paperwork. Actually, it is a lot of paperwork. They had to reincorporate as the Ho-Chunk Nation. They incorporated in 1963 as the Winnebago Business Council. And to become the Ho-Chunk Nation involved a reincorporation. No, they did not have a reservation because they were removed from Wisconsin. And in the Kennedy administration, which of course is, begins in 1961, the Ho-Chunks are actively pursuing finally organizing as a federally recognized tribe. They've always been there, but they didn't have federal recognition. And they were denied because they didn't have tribal homeland. Well, of course not. They were removed. I mean, there was apparently a sympathetic administrator in the Kennedy administration, this is how it's usually described, who found a piece of tribal land that had not been allotted. It did not belong to an individual. It was still tribal land. It was less than 2 acres. And on the basis of that, they were allowed to proceed with a reorganization as the Winnebago Business Council at that point, which is just, the sort of bureaucracy that Native people have to go through.
Still exists.
Oh, yeah. Totally. Yeah. Great. Thank you for coming out today.